Welcome to Tips from the Server Room. This podcast is designed for all you systems admins, network specialists, or the guys and gals out there in the office who handles it all. Sit back, relax, grab a beverage, and enjoy Tips from the Server Room. Hey, yes, welcome back, everybody, once again to Tips from the Server Room. This is episode number 50 for June the 10th, 2014. I'm your host, Jack. This show is a proud member of Tech Podcast. If it's tech, it's here. Check it out at techpodcast.com. Also, if you have a minute, check out my website, tipsfromtheserverroom.com, where you can comment on all these shows. You can also leave me a voicemail message at 724-701-0550. If you have any questions or ideas for future shows, you can drop those in an email and send those to jackstechcorner@gmail.com. And you can follow along with me on Twitter and as @technoman. Today, I thought we would get into a little bit of a show here, talking to you about a client that I've recently been working with and some roadblocks that I've come across, and some things that you may come across actually when you're out there working in the field and you're working with networks and servers, and things that you're going to have to know or at least be aware of anyway to be able to do a really good job for your clients. Now, I know a lot of you out there are probably already doing this stuff, but I still thought it would be good to touch base on it. So this is one of those stories here, one of these shows, kind of like Mike Smith would tell you from the Mike Tech Show, a story from the trenches, I guess, more or less, is what we're going to be talking about today. Now, what I was talking to you about, first of all, what I found about today is all firewalls are not created equal. Now, you're going to say, now, wait, Jack, they are created equal. Firewalls are used, we know, to protect our network inside and only allow certain traffic in, while only allowing certain traffic out. That's what our firewalls are supposed to do. But what I mean is, and what I've came across so many times in my career, is that the clients, for some reason, are all different. These companies take these clients and they do something to them. I don't know exactly what they do to them, but they do something where they only want to connect to certain boxes. Now, I was trying today to use, and I can tell you even what kind of firewall I'm talking about. The firewall is actually a red firewall called WatchGuard. That is particularly the one I was using. Now, I'm used to using Cisco firewalls. I've programmed Cisco firewalls for years. I have the Cisco clients on my thumb drive, so when I go out to a client's place, I can install it. It's very, very easy for me to do that. But this particular firewall needs its own individualized client. Now, I searched the internet high and low trying to find a WatchGuard client to download because I wanted to download this client so I can set up on my client's computer so they can access their network, obviously, from their house. That's the whole idea, to have that secure tunnel. I'm sure you know what firewalls do. And in looking around and digging around to help files, I found the only way to enable me to download this client was you had to log into the firewall pretty much locally, and you would use whatever internal address you give it, and you go to that address with a slash, and then it's SSL, like VPN.htm, and then it's going to ask you for a login. Now, here's a trick. You don't log into the firewall with the administrative or root credentials. You log into the firewall with somebody that has VPN access credentials. So you log into this firewall, and then it's set up to allow you to download the software once you get to that point. Now, you can download the software for either Windows or for the Mac, and, well, unfortunately, I didn't download the software for the Mac. So when I was outside, once I got outside my client's location and I was back on the road and trying to log into it, I found out I didn't have the client. So it didn't do me much good to do that. But then I thought, well, that's okay. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to use the Mac client And I'll use that Mac client, you know, the one that's built into your OS X operating system, and I'll use that to connect in. That's where I found out that all clients are not created equal. The client software that's on OS X would not allow me to make a secure connection back to that firewall. So at that point, I had to go out and, again, scour the internet and try to find a Mac client, which I did. But unfortunately, it's a very old client, and it won't work with the current operating system of OS X. So anyway, I just want you to be aware when you're out there, make sure you understand what type of firewall your client has, how that firewall is set up. Make sure you have the internal as well as the static address for that firewall, because that's going to be how your client has to connect back into their network. They don't use an internal address. They need to have the routable address to log back into their VPN or their firewall. Also, make sure you can get the client software. This is very, very important. You have to have the client software to be able to load onto your client's computer. And that's very, definite and something you have to do is have that client. Also, remember, take it from me, remember to download the client for whatever computer you're using, whatever laptop you own. If you own a Windows laptop, make sure you have that particular client for that. Here's the next issue we ran into. Running two DHCP servers on one network. And we've talked about this in the past on this show when we talked about setting up DHCP and how we set DHCP up. When you have two DHCP servers on one network, you're going to have a problem because the computer, when you turn a computer on or a laptop, it doesn't know where to get its address from. Should it get it from DHCP1 or DHCP2? And I received a lot of emails that said, Jack, you can do this. You can do this because it's very easy to do. And, you know, you would set up one bank on one DHCP server and another bank on another one. But you still have two DHCP servers on your network, both sitting there looking for requests and answering requests. That is not the best way to run your network. The best way to run your network is to have one DHCP server and have that server handing out addresses. Now there is, I'm going to tell you, there is a little something you have to do or something you have to be aware of that kind of will make this a little bit more confusing. But I think I can put it straight out there to you in working with this client and learning the ins and outs of what we had to do for the particular client to get them up and running. Now, the next thing is know where your firewall is in relationship to your outside modem or router. Now, this is key, folks. You can't have a firewall and then have your modem or router. It doesn't work that way. A lot of people think, well, if I bring the inside line in, the network cable in, plug it into my firewall, and then plug it into my modem, and then go to my network, you're kind of defeating some of the purpose. And I'm going to tell you about that in a few minutes of what I found out why you're defeating the purpose. The way you want to have this done is your firewall should be your next to the last device as you go out to the internet. Now, here's what I'm talking about. Say if we have a DSL modem or we have a cable modem. The cable modem is set up with the cable in it. The DSL modem is set up with the DSL obviously in it, and or a phone line or some sort of connection to it. And then you have a network cable. That network cable is your WAN connection, your wide area network connection on your firewall. That network cable. And then there's a LAN network, or your local area network. That is your inside network, and that network is what you're going to use to plug into your switch. Now, here's where it gets a little bit tricky. Your default route on your computers, it is not what you give as an internal address to your actual modem or router or whatever you may have sitting there. The default route is your firewall's address. Now, with that said, there is a lot of modems out there. And I found out this the hard way. There's a lot of cable modems out there that wants to assume the address of number one. So let's say, for instance, if we had 10.16.100.something, and that particular router or cable modem wants to be number one. Now, you can't have your firewall as number one, like I would always want to do that. So what you'd have to do is have that modem as number one, make your firewall number two on its LAN port. So on the LAN port, if you want to get into that firewall, you would type in 10.16.100.2 and you can access your firewall and be able to get into that. Now that we have that clarified, your default route on your local computers then will become .2, the firewall. Once you get to the firewall will be able to determine what traffic is allowed outside your network, and it will route that through your modem at that point, or your cable modem or DSL or whatever you have, and it will route that traffic to the internet. That is how it has to be done. Now, that's how we route packets from inside outside. Sometimes it's good to take a piece of paper, write all your IP addresses down, and look at that. Look at the addresses. I even like to draw little squares or something to say, look, this is my router. This is my firewall. This is my servers. And then kind of attach it almost virtually with paper first. And if you can draw an arrow of the way the traffic is supposed to go out and an arrow of the way the traffic is supposed to come in, that is how your packets are being routed. Sometimes if a packet is not being routed, such as today's case, from inside out, I had to go in the firewall, which I didn't initially install, so I didn't go through the wizards and set everything up. It was installed previously for a DSL connection, but now we switched over to a cable connection to get more high-speed internet traffic. Now, what I had to do was I had to find out why the packets weren't being allowed to go from that firewall out to the internet. And I found that there was some traffic being blocked on one of the firewall rules. A rule is simply set up on a firewall, as you know, to either let some port out or some port in. That is why we have rules set up on the firewall. So I had to go into the firewall and actually had to turn off one of the rules to allow my packets to route from the inside to the outside. Once I did that, the traffic started flowing, the workers were happy, and everything was going perfectly for me. Now, we talked already, and I'm just going through my show notes here, we talked already about understanding the default gateway. Make sure that you realize that your firewall is your default gateway. So whatever address that is, if you have a computer on your network as 10.16.100.100, the default gateway should be whatever IP address you gave on the local area network side of your firewall. So it would be something like 10.16.100.2. That is my gateway. Now, most times, and I would highly recommend it, if you're just setting the firewall up and you don't have to worry about an IP address on your modem or on your cable modem or DSL, I would strongly suggest that you make the firewall .1. You know, anyway, either way you do it, you know, what you need to do is, and we'll talk about this a little bit after here because it looks like I'll have plenty of time to talk, is you have to do some documentation. If you work for clients out there and you don't document what you're doing, and that client calls you back in 3 months, you are going to forget everything you did for that client. So you have to document all this stuff. This is very important. Now I want to tell you about understanding IP subnetting and how it affects your network nodes talking to one another. I was working with the cable guy. He puts the modem in, and the modem, when I first connected to it, was giving me an address outside of the subnet. It was actually a totally different subnet as what the servers and the workstations were currently using. Now, we ran into a problem here. So this might be step one of your documentation. When you walk into a client's office, sit down and do some IP configs on the computers. Figure out what IP subnet those computers are on. because when you go to introduce something else into the network, you are going to start looking at it and you're going to wonder, why is this computer not talking to the server? And you're just going to have a mess on your hands. So you need to know what the IP network or IP subnet is currently, so that way you can take and put everything else in perspective. Also, folks, don't be afraid to get into a Comcast modem and do some configuration. I had to do that. I asked the Comcast guy, I said, well, how do you get in there and change the IP subnets? He told me, I don't know. And I said, that's not the answer I was hoping for. I was hoping for the answer was you would tell me how to log in, you would tell me where these settings are, and I can go in there and I can change them to match the same IP subnet as what the office is currently using. And here's why we didn't want to change IP addresses. First, they had printers, or they have printers mapped to certain computers. Those printers are mapped using their IP address. Now, if I change the IP subnetting, the whole scheme of the IP, I'm going to have to go to every computer and I can go in and hard code it. And I know what you're saying already. Whoa, DHCP, Jack. Yep, you're right. DHCP would do it. But here is the issue that I ran into in this particular office. They have a Linux server, a Linux-based server with their software on it that they use every day to do all their, whatever they're putting in there, all the stuff. I don't want to tell you too much about the client, but their main software package, let's say their invoicing and billing software, was written for a Linux server. And that is currently where it resides. So when I double-click the icon to get into the Linux server, it came up, it said server cannot be found at this IP address. This particular. That's what started cluing me in and saying, wait, now if they're on that subnet and this new cable modem is on this subnet, that will never talk to the other one. You can't make a 10.16 something talk to a 192.168 address. They're not going to communicate. And that is just the way of IP subnetting. That's just the way life is. They're not going to communicate with each other. So what you need to do is first write down the addresses of all the computers, all the iPads, whatever's on your network, and have a good list of what is on there. What you're going to do next is now you're going to go back to that cable modem. Ask the cable guy, whoever it is, whatever company it may be, how to log into it. And the first thing the cable guy told me was why. Why do you want to get into our equipment? I said, well, I'd like to change the IP subnetting, because it's not talking to the IP subnetting of the actual office computers. His next question was, well, how do you know to do that? I said, well, I've been doing this a long time. I know how to make things communicate with IP addresses. And since he didn't know, and I did know, he gave me the username and password. And once I logged in, I said, well, how would you change those IPs? And he said, oh, I don't know. Now, this is where I'm going to tell you, you need to be an investigator. You need to learn to click around somebody's interface. You know what you're looking for. You know you're looking for the LAN settings. You know you're looking for the DHCP server, because you might want to put a DHCP range in there. And you want to get all this stuff together and be able to set that to the same IP subnet. Once I was able to go in there and do that, I was able to go to the computers. They worked fine. The only thing I had to change was the default route. Because remember now, the default route was the .1 that the cable modem has. And we had to change it to a .2 so we can take that address and route that through that firewall. Now, here is a warning to you about the cable companies out there, at least Comcast with, I think they call it Infinity. Is that what they call it? Whatever they call their cable internet. I don't have it here at home, but whatever they call that. They turn on, by default, a public guest access on your cable modem. And I'm telling you here, listeners, beware. Beware of this little niche, I call it. Because when they do that, if you don't have the firewall coming in from your gear to that modem, you are opening up access basically to your network, because it's going to hand them an IP address on your network, and then all your servers will be available. I mean, everything's going to be seen right there, because it's just the way it's going to work. So what you need to do is get the firewall in there. First of all, I would probably just suggest just shut that guest access off. If you're in there anyway and they're not going to know any difference, turn it off. The reason they do that, I guess, if you are a Comcast subscriber and you go to your finance office or your tax guy and you sit down with them, you're in their waiting room and you turn your phone on and it says, oh, log in with your, Infinity or whatever they call that account. So you log in. If you're a cable customer, you log in with your username and password, and you get unlimited internet access to your office gear. Well, you may want to turn that off. Guest access, and everybody knows out there, we did a show on wireless not too long ago, and you know that I am a major opponent, I guess, to allowing guest access on your network. We talked about that. But if you don't have a firewall separating that modem from your network, it should be two separate networks. When they get on that cable modem, the only thing you have to be aware of, the only thing that they should be allowed to have access to, is the internet. If you want to do that, then more power to you. I think it's a wonderful thing to have open guest access. And what the guy told me, if you don't have a username and password, then you get 1 hour of access per month. So if you visit that office and you're only there maybe 15 or 20 minutes, you only go once every 2 or 3 months, maybe it's an eye doctor, you go once a year, you can have access for 1 hour, even if you're not a cable subscriber. And that kind of struck me as being kind of weird, because then if you're outside the building, can you get access if you're in your car? And he said, sure. As long as the wireless signal would reach outside in the car, then sure, you can. You can get that access. And I said, man, that's a little iffy there. But that is just the nature of their business. That's how they do it with the cable company. Now, with that said, make sure your firewall is in line. I'm talking a hardware firewall. I'm not talking about your software firewalls on your computer, folks. Forget that. Put a hardware firewall in, take that firewall, and make sure that that firewall is in between your gear and that cable box or DSL modem. That way, no matter what hits that, they get internet access. And that is where I told you earlier, there is two DHCP servers running. One DHCP server is running on the cable gear to give the guest access an IP address. The other one is running on the firewall to give everybody inside access. Here's the next thing we learned on this little job. If you have a firewall set up, by nature, the firewall is set up, and its idea or its main goal is to protect your network from any outside intrusions. Now, we found out if we used the cable company's wireless connection, and it gave us an IP address in the same subnet range, we could not talk to our server, we could not talk to our printers, or anything else to do with that. And the reason that is because by nature, we are not allowed to go from the outside in to the network. And if we're on that wireless network, you are trying to come back into your own network through that firewall, it will not work. So what we had to do was we put the wireless units, put those inside your network. So have a couple wireless access points, put those in your network, into your switches, and then when a wireless unit hits that, then at that point they are inside your firewall, and everything just talks and works as it should. So as I said, I would recommend that you close the connections to your inside network from your guest access, and that is the only way you can do that. The next thing, we're going to talk just a few minutes about, we're going to talk a few minutes more about this client software and the firewall client software. When you do install it, there is an XML config file on whatever firewall you're using. What that XML config file is supposed to do, it gives the client such things as the shared secret, and it puts all the configurations it needs to have inside of that software. This way you don't have to hard code all that in. And that is the only way you're going to be allowed to access that firewall. Unless you want to write a config file yourself and try to put that out there and try to do all that. Now, the last thing I want to do to wrap this show up, and this show is a little bit shorter today. Also, if you're pulling this around lunchtime on June 10th, you'll notice that it is also earlier today. And the reason that is simply because I have a plan tonight. I have some plans tonight. And, I'm going to not be here when I normally record the show. So I figured I'd record it earlier. So at least we do have a show on Tuesday and you do have something to tune into. I think that's pretty important. The last thing we're going to wrap this show up with, as we were talking a little bit ago about documentation. Documentation is key to your sanity. You have to document everything. And I don't like it. And I know you don't like it. You know, we're in the business of building networks. We're in the business of loading softwares, using Active Directory, setting our DNS servers up, our DHCP reservations, and doing all the fun stuff. We're not really in the business of documentation, right? Well, if you're going to have clients, or even if you work for a company, you need to do network drawings, and you can use something like Visio, or a program that I really like to use a lot for Windows is called SmartDraw. I just find it's a little bit easier to use. It's a little bit easier to understand. Visio is okay. And just because it's the industry leader doesn't necessarily mean you need to use it. But you can get a really inexpensive copy of SmartDraw. I believe it's at smartdraw.com. I'll check and maybe I'll put a couple links in the show notes for those. And you can check those out for yourself. But what they allow you to do, it has little pictures of firewalls in there, computers, and draw your network out. Take some time to draw your network out. Any device, if you have a printer, if you have a fax machine, maybe a copier, anything with a static IP address on it, put those static IP addresses on that documentation. Then you also want to take all of your IP addresses. And I like to put all those into either an Excel document, or I put those into just, a regular document itself, and I document all my IP addresses out. So all my internal addresses I'm going to use, I put them in there, and then those addresses, I write beside there what they go to, where they're at. The next thing you want to document, and a lot of people don't do this, and this gets a lot of people in a lot of trouble, is document your firewall. And by what I mean there is not only the IP addresses, make sure you document your firewall about what traffic you're allowing in, what port you have open coming in, what traffic and ports you're allowing to go out. That is key to keeping your sanity. Now, once you get all these great documents done, you can save them as PDF on a computer. You can save them as a PDF on a thumb drive or flash drive or whatever you want to do to it. At that point, folks, I am a little bit old schooled. Now, what I mean by old school there is I like to take those documents, I print them off, I put them in this nice little sheet protectors, and I put those in a really nice little binder. Because we found one time, we decided to put a lot of our drawings onto Google Docs. We've uploaded them to, the Google, your Google Drive folder. And one day we needed those when our internet traffic went out. We had no internet connection. Well, it turns out that you don't have connection then to your Google Docs. So that wasn't the best case scenario. So here's what I would suggest. When you get these drawings done, save them as a PDF. Keep them in a folder or a file somewhere. And also, take these and print them and create that binder. Because if something happens, if a computer, if a server goes out, you can flip that binder open, you can get your IP addresses, you can know what you're going to do to bring that server back up online. That's really, really key. Once you do all that, put that in a very, very safe place where you know where it's at. Because folks, nobody likes to have a network outage. And when you have a network outage, you should be able, especially if you're full-time somewhere, you should be able to bring your network back up within either a few minutes. If it's a major network outage, maybe an hour. But for those out there who do this stuff, like Mike does, and like I have some clients, for those of us out there that have clients that we worry about that rely on us to be their IT team, they can't afford an IT team to be in the building every day. I know where I just worked today, there's no way they would want somebody sitting around all day just worrying about their computers breaking. I mean, I would have to play an awful lot of games of solitaire, and I'm not a big solitaire fan. But you have to have documentation. And when you go back into that business, open a file up, and then you'll be right back on top of your game. Now, I do like, and a lot of people tell you, Evernote is a godsend. It's just, Evernote is so nice because you can set up notebooks, and you can have a notebook for each client. And in that notebook, you'd have individual notes. Some people like to document on the server. That's okay until the server's no longer there. We used to do a lot of that, where you'd create a a text file and you put it on that server. The idea is, and it's a really good idea, is that if something went wrong and you're no longer available, you're not there, you're with another client, somebody else would go in there. They can double click on that text document. You can call it like server, whatever, server updates, or they would at least have something to go by based on what you've typed in there. So that's not a bad idea. The only thing I don't like about that is if the server's not up and you need that notebook or that text document, well, you're not going to be able to get it. So whatever you write in there, also write it into your Evernote, and then you would have that available at all times. Because, I mean, I even bring stuff up on my phone, bring it up on your iPhone or on your Android phone, and you have access to your Evernote from anywhere that you might be. And it's really, really just, I can't say enough about Evernote. Those are great guys. I met the programmers once, and it's a great group of people. And they have much, much more staff now than when I first met them some years ago. But they still do a great job. And when new software comes out, they always update their packages, so everything just kind of works, and it's wonderful. So, folks, that's it. I hope you've enjoyed this show, and I want you to remember, like I said, main thing is think about those firewall clients. Think about your firewall. Make sure it's up and running and it's where it needs to be. It needs to be the next to the last device to the internet. So have your firewall and then have your internet, either modem or DSL. Documentation, I can't tell you enough and stress enough that you need to document. What I like to do is when I leave a client, if I have time, I like to stop at a Starbucks and grab a cup of coffee, open your computer up and go in there and actually type everything out. You can do that. It works out really, really well. You can even take an iPad. Just type that out. Type it on your phone. I've done that at one client's once. I was sitting and I was running some updates on their server. I took out my iPhone. I opened Evernote and I started typing up my documentation of what I did that day. You can't go wrong by documenting. So, folks, I want to thank everybody out there that's been signing up for my server courses. I'm glad they're helping you out. I've been getting a ton of thank you emails, and I really appreciate that. I've always said I like to pay it forward. When I go out and learn this stuff, I like to come back and share it with everybody. That's why I set those server courses up. Now, somebody did email me, and I'm going to be straight up and honest with you. They said, Jack, will your courses prepare me to take the Microsoft cert test? No, it's not on that basis. These courses are set up for the guys and girls out there, or any of us that's been in this business for a long time, maybe as a refresher, or to learn from A to Z, from install to administration, how to run a Windows server. That is key. Also, remember, if you don't have high-speed internet, you can order these on DVD, the videos. And you can order the videos at jackstechcorner.com. Click the pull-down menu, and you will see the DVDs. So if you want to learn Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012, or VMware ESXi 5.5 Server from install to administration, you can sign up for the online courses, and that is the absolute best way to do this. So many people email me and say, Jack, is it better to get the DVDs? Or is it better to do the online courses? The online courses are a lot better because once you order the DVD, you get the videos currently that I have available. If I come up with a new lesson or a new course subject, I put it online. So if you're on the online course, you'll get emailed and say, hey, there's a new video available. You might want to go watch it. But these are very much in order. I start from the install. We go all the way through administration. We talk about IIS, DNS. We talk about DHCP. Everything you need to know to run that server. You can find it at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Look for the online class link at the top of the page. Click on that. The courses are very much self-paced. I've had people in there, some people took the course in a week, and I had some other people who are still on the course and they've been on there for a few years. All you do is watch a video and you take a short quiz. Once the course is complete, I will mail you a certificate. And a lot of people are using these certificates to put with their resumes to say, hey, I have this this talent with servers. I took this course. Some people just take the certificate and frame it and hang it in their office. It is a good-looking certificate, and you'll be happy once you earn that. Once again, you can sign up for that at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Folks, have a great work week. If there is such a thing, I'm sure there is. I currently got a few days break here from work, so I've been kind of kicking back and relaxing a little bit. Other than the client today, but you know, you do have our obligations we have to fulfill, and I do have a very, very busy week this week. So I wanted to get the show out there to you anyway. Make sure you had it so you can listen to it maybe today on the way home instead of tomorrow on the way to work. So until next Tuesday, be around again for another show. I'll talk to you then. Take care, everybody, and I'll see ya. You just listened to Tips from the Server Room with your host, Jack. If you have any questions, please drop me a comment at tipsfromtheserverroom.com. Thanks again for tuning in and downloading the shows. Now sit back, relax, and listen to the remainder of the music. We'll see you next week on Tips from the Server Room. So long.